time to listen to the interviews from Island Life on Saturday the 15th of October 2011. Island Life is our weekly magazine show focusing on Waiheke people, events and issues. It's brought to you every Saturday morning from 10 till 12 by The Village Butchery. You'll find them at 102 Oceanview Road, Oneroa. On Saturday the 15th of October, Shrim Brown talked politics and current affairs with Reverend Moore, Greg Tribwell and Waiheke Radio's Martini.
Now we're back with Reverend Moore. And Reverend Moore is quite an active person in the Samoan community and in the youth, and works a lot with youth. And he's here to talk about some of the arts activities he's involved in, and we've got some music. So how's it going?
Kia ora, tarafalava, Moore here. Awesome to be here, thank you.
Lovely, great. So there's an arts project in Queen Street which has just started yesterday, and you're involved with it. Would you like to tell us about that?
Yes, it's called the Performance Arcade. It's 7 shipping containers, 20 artists, 10 days. It's from October the 14th to the 23rd, 2011 at Aotea Square. And the Performance Arcade is a line of shipping containers arranged to provide a series of miniature performance and installation spaces for 7 New Zealand artists, curated by award-winning director-designer Sam Truebridge from the Playground New Zealand Limited. And these are sites of encounter, engage the public through a range of technologies and performances. So very honoured to be with Linda T, of course, a good friend of ours. Linda T is this awesome urban Pacific woman who's done photography, who's done urban history, and is just a real inspiration to a lot of our people out there in terms of just getting in, being in those places during what I would call critical Pacific periods of urban history in Aotearoa.
Yeah. So, and it's interesting because it's coinciding with the World Cup as well. So there'll be lots and lots of people wandering through.
I think it's a fantastic occasion. We spent yesterday just talking to the young people, the children. The thing I like about Linda T's works and her installation is the whole idea that it's accessible to ordinary people. It's accessible to communities. It's about using technologies, in her case, moving images. Therefore, she's got this beautiful couch. It's got all the gears for what would look like a TV show come sitcom. And yet it's about us, you and I, and people being able to sit down and have a good old chin wag and at the same time feel like, hey, this is not bad, I'm enjoying this. And then her end of the process is that she gives you a lovely DVD with, you know, images of you and what you're talking about. And so I'm really looking forward to, I'll be there every 2 o'clock. I've got a whole range of music, short films, music video clips that I'll be playing and talking to, and doing that whole thing of what I call urban Pacific music, urban Pacific history, and just chilling and enjoying it. And it was fabulous yesterday, you know, that whole thing of saying hello to all the Welsh people, the French people, and even Australians. And,
oh no, really stooping.
Well, you know, it was a really interesting thing to be able to sit in a container and talking on a mic and sharing with people and then playing your favourite music. I mean,
in the middle of Aotearoa Square.
Exactly, I mean, yeah. And then being able to tell people, hey, the mayor lives just behind us, so feel free to go visit him for a cup of tea.
Yeah. Oh no, excellent. And so if you're walking past, is there a chance that you might find yourself on the podium, or is it
very much so?
It's specified guests that have to arrange beforehand.
It's a bit of special guests, but if you're lively and you look like a fun person to enjoy, I could well imagine you'll be allowed in. And it's a lovely setting. It's a container. I mean, when was the last time you were in a container, sitting on a couch and talking about the world and your reflections and thinking, does anyone care?
Right. Okay, I'd have to say that would have to be a no. Never done that. So that's something to look forward to.
Oh, very much so.
And so you're there every day? I mean, you're every day at 2, but
yep.
How's the installation working? It's open from 12 till 8, is that right?
Yes, it's open from 12 to 8. Now, I can only talk about Linda T's one, which is, you know, container number 7. So there's 7 containers, fabulous art pieces, installations, interactive. And I saw the Tongans, they've got theirs there. Australian, and I was very naughty. My observation of it was that it was very 70s. It's a performance based with these awesome Tongan artists, performance artists, and doing the whole thing of being in a cage with a pig. And the interaction between the pig and captivity and man, this whole deep imagery.
Oh, interesting.
It is.
And so is there a specific theme to all the containers? Are all the containers representing some sort of specific theme?
Yeah, there is. There's a whole sense of it's a group of diverse artists with different backgrounds. A lot of the Pākehā artists are just absolutely incredible. And they're just so rich with ideas, technologies. And yeah, I'm looking at number 7. And what I was thinking was there are artists that are really breaking new ground. They're exciting, they're challenging, and it's that whole misconception or conceptions of processing what is reality, what is art, and how do we respond as a community. And it's exciting, people. There's this pig in this confined space, and there's these two incredible artists who are basically performing with the pig, if I could put it that way. I was a bit mean because I've actually read about this and watched the documentary on this back in the 70s when man was asking the questions of its inhumanity to animals and the whole thing of keeping animals locked up, killing animals so that we could consume them, and the inhumane way that we deal to animals. So I've just been informed by Linda that this piece that's in the containers by our Tongan artist is an award-winning piece.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Is it funny? Have you is it supposed to be a funny piece or a serious piece? What's the tone of it?
I think it's meant to be a bit of both. I think it's meant to go from one extreme to the other. It's satirical, it's sad, it's ironic, it's tragic. And depending on the mood of the pig and how the Tongans are feeling, it sort of brightens up your day, or it could make you very, very sad. So yesterday was they introed it with a man walking with another man who had a leash, and they were throwing bananas on the ground, and the other actor, I suppose we'd call him, would be eating the banana that was on the ground.
Right.
And then he jumps into this cage, and then surprise, surprise, we all become aware that there's a little piglet on the other side with this man.
A real piglet.
A real piglet. And all I kept thinking was, why am I feeling sorry for the piglet and not the Tongan?
Right.
You know, so obviously there's irony in there. It's yeah, you've got 9 more days.
Wow.
Find out, will the piglet survive?
So for all of those people who are looking for things to do with their kids in school holidays, it sounds like you could spend a good couple of hours looking at the different installations and seeing what's out there.
Oh,
lots to think
brilliant.
About and participate in.
Oh, yes, there is. It's interactive. There's also all the umbrellas. There's like a forestry of umbrellas that you can go into. And, it's really visual. The one that Linda really enjoyed was the container that you walk in. And as you move around, your body is being captured by the lighting and the setting up of the container, and every time you move you create a new sound, and it retraces your step and recreates the sound for you. And really imaginative, isn't it?
Yeah.
And then in the other container further down is two awesome men who are cycling, creating a power generator,
right,
to play their favorite records.
Oh, wow. Okay. They'll be tired by the end of the day. Certainly your bit about sitting on the couch, they drew the short straw then. You got the one where you sit there on a couch and chat to people, and they get the bit where they have to cycle like crazy to get even a song played.
It is. And they're cycling.
They'll be rethinking that one.
Oh, isn't it? And then the other thing that made me laugh too was it also generates their little laptop that they've got there. So they're also, I gather, on internet, community communicating with people that might be interested about their art project. And it's this whole, isn't that incredible?
Yeah, they'd have to pedal really fast though to be able to get the laptop to work as well.
That's
poor things.
That's it, eh? And I gather it goes in, and I think it's on Facebook or something, and they're keeping the people informed, and I don't know.
Yeah.
It's,
whoever said that, you know, you were a couch potato if you sat behind the computer all day. Hey?
Oh, I'll tell you, there is an irony in there.
Yeah.
And, you know, people, you just got to enjoy the city. It's buzzing with the World Cup.
Isn't it amazing?
I know. I mean, I love sports, but even all my friends who are not sports people have been, how shall I put it? This has been a really good moment for us just to get in behind something and feel good about it.
I agree. And the other thing, well, we'll talk about it after. What's this track 7?
This is track 7. People, it's a very romantic old song. It's taken from the 50s, but it's, yeah, I like it because it's a lovely new rendition, jazz, and it's Pacific Underground from Dunedin, Christchurch, who have gone and put these beautiful old tracks together and have given it a new, refreshing sound of 2011. It was a finalist in the Pacific Music Awards for Best Album. So it's a beautiful track, and it's a lovely old track called Lovely Hula Hands.
Lovely. Well, back with Moo in a minute. Lovely Hula Hands now. And I think it's blank. Yes, here we go.
Yep, that's it. It's a nice slow beat, don't worry. Lovely hula girl, I'm in a world crazy over you. In your lovely hands, all of my plans promise to be true. Lovely hands that seem to say, happiness will pass away. All the love we may send, caring not how it will end. Sunset is a flame, burning your name in the skies above. And the silent night shines with the light in the eyes I love. I never knew. All the world is only you, whirling in the dance you do. Lovely hula girl, whirling in the dance you do. Lovely hula girl.
Lovely. Great. Well, that was lovely hula hands. And great. So, Mua, I just wanted to ask you... Oops, sorry. Just take that off. I just wanted to ask you about the Pacific feel of this World Cup. I just feel that, you know, the islands have really come into their own, and that's one thing that I really love about the centre of Auckland now. There's just lots of... just a lovely Pacific vibe, and it's not just about, you know, New Zealand.
Yeah, I'd have to agree with you there. As an Aotearoa born Ngāti Hāmoa of Samoan Chinese descent, I've been, and I know we can easily go off on a tangent about negativity. I know that we can critique it really to the nth degree, but I do have to say, as a Pacific person who lives on Waiheke Island, who travels in every morning, it's been absolutely brilliant. Just the whole taste and the whole feel of, you know, the cloud, and also the whole setting of the mood of the nation, and then watching the gathering of the people and the pride. What I see also too is that in 1987, when we won the World Cup, one of the memorable moments of the 87 World Cup, without a doubt, has to be Michael Jones. And so you had this whole thing of being very mindful that there was a rugby icon called Michael Jones in that very successful 87 team. This time round, I have to say, there is a very distinct Pacific flavour that's coming through very strongly from the campaigns, from the people that are there, the performers, the input, the Pacific Conference, just the whole flavour of our Pacific nations in the World Cup, on the field, and also in terms of around it. It's just been absolutely just... Oh, I've felt really, really privileged. I've felt really, really touched to see this, other than... you know, just the players. I've seen people that are doing the journalism. I've seen the people that are doing the arts and the cultural. And I'm just really, really chuffed. I mean, 87, I was a young new parent. 2011, I'm a grandfather. I'm taking my grandchildren down there. We're sharing the moment, just as the whole nation is. And I think also, too, there is a learning curve in this whole thing. And that is that our children and our grandchildren are watching us. And I think that we have to set up the learning for them, and so far as that we can either win or lose. Either way, we've got to set the examples. Like, if it goes great, hey, people celebrate, but be gracious. If we lose, I know, I can't figure that one. But if we should, we're adults, and we're going to show our children that we can handle loss, and that we can move on with life. And so there are all these really good things that we can learn from this.
Mm. And I think that's really interesting, that whole thing of the status that comes with hosting one of these huge events. I know whenever in the run-up to all of these things, I'm always like, oh, God, you know, always seems like, you know, interminable, the talking about it on radio and blah, blah, blah. But it's incredible. I was in Barcelona just before the Olympics, and the change in Barcelona after the Olympics, instead of being this sort of, you know, the arse end of Europe where everyone went to for cheap wine and, you know, basically had cheap maids and whatever that came from Spain, the whole status of Spain just really came up. Mm. And it really had an amazing energy after that. The same with Australia. You know, Australia often, in terms of England, people, you know, used to sort of think, oh, you know, we're not quite as confident as the English. Australia, you know, England is really a much more desirable place to be. And I really felt that after being in Australia with the Olympics again, it was that thing of, hang on a minute, we've got it all. This is the place to be. There was a real confidence that came with that. And I'm feeling that again with the World Cup here, that, you know, suddenly it's like, we're not just, you know, Pacific Island nations, and, you know, we're not that. We are Pacific Island nations, and we have so much to offer and so much that is really cool. And other people are coming from really far away to enjoy that and are seeing it on TV.
I think also what you've picked up on is totally what John Key's missed, and that's the whole thing of putting the value on the dollar. And if you're going to value the whole World Cup on dollars, well, we already know it's made a loss.
Mm.
You know, so, hey, guess what, John Key? You start us with a premise and you've ended up being the loser.
Yeah.
I listened to to Lahore, the famous manager of the 87 team that won the World Cup for New Zealand. And he summed it up really well, and I thought, good old New Zealand, you know. And he's a good example of it. He turned around, he said, what we are good at as New Zealanders is that we have fantastic hospitality. When these people came from overseas, and in particular he was talking about the team that everyone forgot, that poor South African team, and I keep saying their name wrong.
Namibia.
Yes. And just the whole community coming in, looking after them, so much so that that community felt a strong sense of that they went to all the games.
Yeah.
You know, and that whole going for dinner, when they went to have dinner, Lahore thought, oh, jeepers, I've done a wrong one here. I've run out of people to take the team out, because he was expecting only to take 15.
Right.
They saw the hospitality, turned around and says, oh, we need 51. 51 host. And
so the whole of Namibia came over.
Well, it was all the coaches, the support coaches. They really got in. They thought it was fabulous how this rural New Zealand community opened their doors. And what happened through that was friendships. And I think that's what we're forgetting, you know, with all this corporate tribalism, with all the corporate muck-ups that we've had over this All Black thing, from Adidas to telecom. You know what? We have to bring it back to what it's about. It's a sport. It's about the people. And what Lahore reminded me was, you know, that rural New Zealand got in behind and have been absolutely brilliant hosting. You know, and it's another thing that my son and I have been fighting over, and you're going to love this. It's about treasured memories. It's about giving our children really beautiful memories. Whether we win or lose, it's about the process of, you know, that we had photo opportunities, we had dinners. You know, like our family, we're doing a whole day of celebrating the World Cup final. We're going to have games for the children. We're going to do barbecues. We're going to go and have photos outside Eden Park. We're going to do all these things because it's the children. You know, 87, I was very privileged. I was a sort of brand new father and just enjoying it. This time around, I'm a grandfather and I'm enjoying it. And it's about the people. And you're so right. Our country, the whole global suffering of that stupid economic crisis that's been brought on by greed. Yeah, okay, it's there and we know it's there, but let's seize the moment of that. You know, it's all right to feel good about certain things, like, you know, having a good time with our families and just, you know, enjoying it, and then getting ready for the battle of, you know, the elections, making sure that we practice our vote, making sure that it's about the things that we believe in and the people that we love.
Lovely. Excellent. Now, you've got a track here. Do you want to just tell us about this one? Sounds quite interesting.
Oh, people, I've got to tell you about this. I'm a typical Samoan parent, but other people tell me I'm just a typical parent. And that is that you love your children. And my son's been very blessed. He's in a group called Nisha Mystics. And they've been around for 10 years. They've won numerous awards. And in particular, I've picked this track because I listened to it and I was so embarrassed, because I also teach hip-hop. And I was so embarrassed when the young people had to point out to me, oh, sir, the guy doing the third verse in Japanese, yes, it's your son. You know, and I went, what? And so I had to put it back on again, listen to it, and they were right, it was my son.
Oh my goodness, it's so you didn't even realize.
Oh yeah, it's a beautiful song about, you know, don't forget who you are, protect your culture and love your family. And this went to number 2 in Japan, and so yeah, it's called Connected.
Lovely. And where is it in New Zealand?
At the moment, it hasn't really been played in New Zealand, so you're really lucky to be here in Waiheke, getting to hear a track that's not often heard, and yet it was number 2 in Japan.
Which one of these tracks is it?
It's number 1.
Number 1. Okay, here we go.
Everything's good, but we strive all the same. We're caught, but when it's time, us above, they kinda different. prompt and we're always late when it comes to food. 僕らその勝手に It's good to be back ただいま心の中にいらないよその飾りは青一人の愛思いやりと出会えそうもな Still connected この星の中 Hey We go way back Navigated the same tracks It's you and I Together side by side Side by side We go way back 昔は現実昔は Same tracks 一つだった互いの違い引き返してそう Side by side Clouds over here, blue sky Some things never change as time passed by Like mom's the word And definite you heard Adolescent years Listen taken as a lesson learned And papa goes to work But mama stays home Representing the hood So singing the same song No matter how far Just a phone call away You got love for the music And I feel the same 肌の色育つ国一人一人異なる歌作り場所 don't forget見えるものだけじゃねえたどれば繋がる二つの夢愛国心確かに大事でも認めなきゃいつまでも怪人見た目じゃない見えるものだけじゃない決して頭のステレオタイプ Hey We go way back Navigated the same tracks It's you and I Together side by side Side by side Hey We go way back 昔は現実昔は現実互いの違い引き返してそう The differences 少しの違い生まれは遠くても心は近い Yeah, we seem different with our own kind of sway To understand the music until you depress play The differences 少しの違い生まれは遠くても心は近い Yeah, we seem different with our own kind of sway To understand the music until you depress play From my hito bito, my 家族 and my 友達 For the idols on gear, we stay to Nagari From New Zealand to Japan, and so Naji The ways of my people pass down live on the sidelines Strength in numbers, I can't lose on my brothers It's a rainy day, we walk, wait for the summer no more Jinji Sabe, to him, but no silence Erase the leaders and move on to the next stop More kore kore, move forward for me Hito sore sore, stay strong, fight over Same things, erase page by page I don't want your money, just give me some change At the end of the day, we wanted the same Keep doing the dues to get ahead of the game夢には懸命人には丁寧 Cause we need your mystery man We thinking the same thing Hey We go way back Navigated the same tracks It's you and I Together side by side Side by side Hey We go way back 昔は現実昔は Same tracks 一つだった互いの違い引き返してそう Side by side Side by side Hey We go way back Navigated theTracks. It's you and I together side by side, side by side. We go way back. 昔は現実昔は Same tracks. 一つだった互いの違い引き返してそう Side by side, side by side.
Great.Well, thanks for that. That was lovely. I love that sort of fusion where you hear songs sung in different languages. Terrific. Okay, great. Well, we've been joined by Greg Treadwell. Kia ora. And, oops, and I actually haven't switched your mic on because I need to switch the music off as I switch your mic on. Meet you at the dance floor. Well, okay, you may well like it, but this is a discussion show. So, and Martini Gotcha, environmental activist, and Reverend Moore is still with us. And we're just going to talk to you about this show, Fathers and Sons.
Yep, thank you for that, people. That track was Nija Mystics with Connected.
And It's a track from Japan, and one of the questions was asked, how come it's not in New Zealand? Well, the reason why is because the Japanese company released it only in Japan. And further to that, I've just finished doing a show called Fathers and Sons. And we've just recently performed it down in Christchurch, two sellout nights. And very humble affair, going from being a lonely Presbyterian minister to an artist who's actually doing something with some fabulous artists. And on the project, it's a really sound concept. It's the ideas of three fathers with their famous sons. And on this particular project, we had from the Pākehā side, Chris from Pacific Underground, his beautiful father, Laurie, who's one of New Zealand's top jazz pianists. And then also on this was myself with my son, Feliti, from Nisha Mystic. And then the two that really rocked the show in the evening, my very good friend, Tingi Lo Ness, and his fabulous son, Shay Fu. And we had a fabulous time. There was an observation that was made, and that was that the Pākehā side didn't seem to talk much on stage, but their jazz music was just absolutely riveting. And then when the Brown people got on, it was, well, my son and I, we were the comedy. We had things going wrong and then turning around and blamed the old guys. And then we had a fabulous time. We had jazz, you had spoken word poetry, you had hip-hop, and then you had reggae, of course, with Tingi Lo being a pioneer of South Pacific reggae in Aotearoa. And then, oh, that beautiful voice of Shay Fu. Now, people, I got to tell you, Shay is a fabulous singer, and as I watched him perform with his dad, it became obvious to me, I can see him doing a whole show of doing those classic songs of the Rat Pack, Dean Martin-type songs with, and, you know, people would pay to go see that. And as
there have been quite a few people who've done those kind of revival type things,
they,
you know, like,
you know,
Robbie Williams and
oh, it is, and it's and what was really incredible about the whole experience was to be in Christchurch, and to have that fabulous, very Pākehā audience, and that were enjoying the show. So, I have to say congratulations to Christchurch Festival for making it a tight package of that. You came to it was being sold as get a ticket, come and take dad to it, and then you can go watch the All Blacks with your dad afterwards. And so, really good packaging, eh? And it really kept that theme. And
excellent. So it was a 2-hour show, or it seems to have gone on for quite a few hours.
Yeah, it's almost a 2-hour show.
Lovely. So talking, fun, jokes, playing
music,
hanging out with dad,
and it was tough. I've got to give you a good example of this. Shay Fu woke up in the morning, 9 o'clock in the morning, and his dad was waking him up, and then he went, I had the worst flashback. I woke up, I looked at my dad, I said, Dad, give me another half an hour and I'll go to school. You know, and then he realised. He went, wait a minute, Dad, we're on tour. No one gets up to 12. You know, and I'm sure, and Tingi turns around and goes, son, you're a busy man, and we're going to have father and son time. We're going to have a nice breakfast. And you're going to enjoy it. And so we had a lot of those sorts of moments where and the other occasion that our minder was cracking up was seeing two of the stars walking out and both fathers separately saying to their sons, it's cold outside, go get a jacket. And, you know,
excellent.
So yeah, fathers and son coming next year, look forward to getting your support. But look, let's get back to the real issues.
Yes, okay, so the last real issue, and maybe you guys will have something to say about this, because we're segueing into, there's an Occupy Queen Street march today at 5, or Occupy Britomart, and it's all about, it started in the States, that, you know, 99%, we are the 99%, and you're involved in Poverty Month.
Yes. People, as you may or may not be aware, there was International Poverty Day, and the Service Workers Food Union is actually taking on board that and are making it an actual Poverty Month, and as part of their campaign in, you know, with Labour, it's being taken as a campaign to highlight poverty and also connect it to the elections, and to also make the connection of poverty and also an opportunity to practice, to use your political will if you wish, in terms of voting on the issue. Because as you can well imagine, a lot of us see the connections of that right-wing Tories, that whole thing of profiting, and also the reason why greed and why the whole thing of exploitation of the environment, the people, and the types of society that we're now inheriting is not being positive. And so that whole take on a commitment to social justice, a better society, looking after the environment and the relationships of people are more fundamental and are much more valued than being told by the rating of some bank overseas how much our value is.
Mm.
And so
So can I just ask, I mean, opening it up to Greg and Martini, do you think people are getting poorer in society? I mean, is that a myth? Because when you see them talking in Parliament, the National Party does seem to be saying that, you know, it is a myth.
Yeah, well, I think that it isn't a myth. I think the figures will show you that it isn't a myth. Shall I keep going?
I'm not sure why you're not showing up on the mic. What is going on with this?
Is that better? Yeah. That sounds better.
You can start again. Okay. We missed all of that.
Look, well, first of all, thanks for inviting me along again today.
And turning on the mic.
And turning on the mic. And it's a real honour to be here with Martini and Moore, both of whom I think are extraordinary islanders. And I think that we've all got our own kind of take on a very, important kind of stuff that we want to talk about today. And I think that we've got a really good representation of the communities in the studio at the moment. I think that's a really fertile place to talk about this stuff, because I think
what's your feeling about it?
Well, okay, so Occupy Auckland, poverty, I think I work at AUT where I teach journalism, and one of my students this week wrote a story about the number of food parcels coming out of the City Mission and how it's still on a serious rise, 9,000 food parcels in the last year. How many a day is that? You know, that's 30 a day from one place. And
is that more than it was before?
Because for the last, I don't have those particular figures with me, sorry, but for the last 3 years, there's been a steady climb of food parcels coming out of the City Mission. I mean, the rhetoric at the top of politics is so tainted with self-interest and envy and political envy that I just don't think we can take that much of truth out of the rhetoric from either of the major political parties.
That's right.
In terms of poverty, we're talking poverty here. And I think that John Key may have grown up in a state house, but he is so removed from the reality that most New Zealanders are living. I can't accept that.
And it definitely seems to be talk to the people on the ground. Like, I know someone who's in the budgeting, who's helping budgeting service help people budget, and you can't budget if you have no money. And that's the struggle that people are up against. It's not that they're not allocating it properly, it's that they have no money to allocate. There's another lady who works with City Mission as well. She's a doctor, and she was saying it's not that people don't have houses, but they are vulnerably housed, so they're not on the street, but they're sleeping on different people's couches every day, or their parents have them for a bit or whatever, but it doesn't mean that they are have a roof over their heads and are living comfortably enough and have a job. They're extremely vulnerable, and the numbers there, she said, are just increasing out of proportion.
Yeah, there's no doubt that the rich are getting richer and the poor is getting poorer. It's a standard kind of thing, but the reality is it is that way. And the difference is indeed getting bigger. It's not so much maybe that the poor is getting poorer, but in terms of money, they're getting poorer because the whole society around them is getting more expensive.
Yeah.
And to be very honest, if you have to grow up on the DPB or an unemployment benefit, the amount of money you get is simply not enough. I was born and raised in Holland, and the social system was based on the minimum wage. So everybody who was unemployed, you get a guaranteed minimum wage and the amount of money you could live on it. You're not rich, you're not getting anywhere, but you could live on that. And I feel here nowadays, because Holland has changed too, it's not the case anymore, the whole world seems to go in a direction of it's everybody for themselves.
Yeah, that individualistic, that neoliberal concept of the individual is terribly damaging to what I think societies need to provide first and foremost for its citizens, which is dignity. If you don't have dignity, then, oh, look, crime spirals. What a surprise. We have to return dignity to ordinary people. And through that, and Martini, I think you're right, if there aren't jobs, and thanks very much to capitalism for making sure there aren't jobs always, then then if there aren't jobs and you can't get a job, and then to leave you in an undignified position is only going to bring in all sorts of social shit, obviously.
Mm.
Yeah.
So can I ask you then, where does this Occupy Wall Street fit into all of that?
Well, I'm pleased to see a little bit of it in Auckland, to be honest, Sharon. And I'm impressed that, it's Facebook, and, you know, about as trustworthy.
2,000 people have
Yeah, 2,000 people have said on Facebook that they're coming. 65,000 people hate a rugby referee. I mean, Facebook just doesn't do it statistically for me. I just don't. 5,000 people will say something on Facebook and 25 will turn up. So we'll see. But,
well,
but
I have a feeling
what
it'll be the other way. I suspect it'll be, you know, 2,000 have said they'll come, but in fact, lots of people who might in fact be more affected by this than the 2,000 who can access Facebook and make a comment will actually be there.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter how many turn up today. What matters is how it grows over the next 6 weeks.
So you're not feeling that it's, nobody's feeling it's a kind of a copycat thing, Occupy Wall Street, I know, let's all occupy Auckland.
No, because if globalisation is the problem, then the response has to be global. And I think that the world is so much cut up these days by class and not nation. I've got the people in working class, people in New Zealand, they've got more to do with working class people in Peru, to be honest, than the top of society, than the wealthiest of society. So I think it's excellent that it's spreading around the world, because if globalization is behind it, and Martina and I were chatting just before we came on about how globalization in some ways has got a lot to do with what's going on in Tauranga today. You know, globalization is the problem. We're transporting stupid goods across the world in containers on rusty ships. I mean, just because we feel so market driven that if we don't get a little bit of profit, let's drop the quality of the ship to make sure the profit comes in. Where are today's values?
Also, when you're looking at the review of what happened down underground with the miners, the shortcuts that were taken, so-called cost effectiveness, and yet if you weighed it up with the safety of the workers, the people, in terms of the accountability back to the communities, we see the same old story coming through again. Profit was the motive. And then the other thing that we've got to be really careful of is that we're handing National another disaster, and that they've been able to score points on the suffering of our people, which I think is really disgusting and disgraceful. And I think we need to be mindful too that we need to make the connections of that these are issues that do affect everyone. And I think it's also an issue that must remind them again of justice. And I think, you know, yes, it was Wall Street, Auckland, I'm hoping, just like the rest of us that are gathered here, that others will turn up. And it's not going to be the numbers. It's going to be important that the people turn up that can make it and can begin to say quite clearly the connections are there. I work with at-risk young people. My observation is that it is critical. At the moment right now, we're having to feed students before we start class. Now, I don't know where the hell that came from, but we've just noticed in the last 5 years, we're feeding them. My personal thing was, no, why should we be feeding them? Yet it's become obvious as we talk to the families and the children, their answers are straight out, there's no food at home.
Mm-mm. AUT's the same. One day a week they feed people, and there's a queue going round the building with people eating. Yeah. And who feeds university students? It's bizarre.
Yeah. And it's incredible then to see that the meat patties ending up on the beach and kids in New Zealand going hungry to school. What was the number? A fair number, wasn't it? A couple of hundred thousand. Mm. And here we are. New Zealand produces so much food.
People should absolutely not be going hungry.
No.
And what's interesting is that I think New Zealanders, no one wants to see anyone going hungry, and yet the political will to sort that out doesn't seem to be there.
And if the political will to sort out the hunger issues in New Zealand isn't there, what hope have we got for wider worldwide hunger issues?
Now, the other issue was this thing of accountability that you spoke about. And I think that's interesting, because one of the things that's come out of this, this boat that's washed up on the rock, is this issue of, of course they'll pay for the cleanup. But then what do you do in a global environment where the ship is registered in one country, crewed by another set of people from another country? you know, registered in another country. I mean, it's just, you know, it's a Liberian...
Registered in Liberia.
Registered, Greek owners registered in Liberia with a Filipino crew or something.
Yeah, that's...
I mean, it's just
right.
bizarre. Who's but accountable and where do they get tried and how do they get tried and what kind of accountability is
and
there?
And why didn't they have a decent chart?
The bottom line of...
Oh, that's a bit trivial.
The bottom line is that I've been a seaman for 30 years and during the last, it started about 10 years ago, that there's an incredible shortage of qualified deck officers, captains and the mates, engine room. There's just an incredible shortage, which means that who is going to man these ships? Now, it's business. They have to make a profit. I would like to know how much money actually these people are getting paid on board that ship. The captain is probably all right, but the rest of the crew, it's slave wages. So I think because this globalization, the show of moving stuff has to go on, they have to become then, they have to lower their standards to keep these vessels manned. And to me, the company is really responsible for I don't know how good or bad these people are. I don't want to go on the individual people. I don't want to go on the fact that they're Philippines. It could be from any
Absolutely.
Country.
Absolutely.
And but the bottom line is that we have all these ships sailing around the world, and there are so many people who are standing on the bridge who really shouldn't be on the bridge. Mm. You know,
that's right. And I was having a giggle about the chart, but really,
why?
Because
Astrolabe Reef didn't appear a month ago. You know, and there's just something's gone fundamentally wrong. And like Martini, I don't know what went on board that ship that day, or the quality of the crew, or the officers, or the skipper. I have no idea at all. And I think it's appalling that they're having to be protected with anonymity because people fear for the crew and even the skipper. You know, you can't be named because there's some likelihood of New Zealand's retaliating. I find that appalling. I can't believe that. I actually don't believe it. I don't really think. I don't want to believe that those crew members and that skipper are in any kind of danger from the New Zealand public. I think that's rubbish. Probably.
Yeah.
We've got to look at the systems. Why, for example, does the insurance and monetary system end up with a $12 million cap on their liability? So if that company can survive this, because its liability is actually capped at $12 million, and this is going to cost hundreds of millions, and the New Zealand taxpayer is going to pick that up, There's some screwy shit going on.
Mm. I think also, too, my other observation is that isn't it fascinating that under the act that Parliament passed, you know, that they had a minimum cutoff of how much these people can be prosecuted and the amount that they are liable for, you know, and if that wasn't protecting friends, if that wasn't being seen as giving way for insider to their colleagues or their part of the economic chain, then, you know, we really have a fabulous metaphor here on hand of the beehive being that boat that's going to go onto that sandbar.
The other interesting thing is I think this whole thing, I mean, Martina and I have both done things around civil defence for Waiheke Island, and they bang on about civil defence emergencies. Surely in a sea-locked country, you know, a boat crashing into a rock is actually quite, you know, a feasible kind of accident to happen.
Yeah. And it's not the first, is it? We've got experience of shipping disasters in New Zealand. It didn't come out of the blue.
Exactly. Yeah. And so why has there been, you know, I was on the ferry with a woman yesterday and she was like, surely there's a plan. Surely they had a plan. And it seemed that no, they were busy trying to work out the plan for the first week that it happened. And even now, I'm not even clear what the plan is. And
well, you have to keep it in perspective, of course. When you get a ship like that of 250 meters long, it end up on the reef. you got a major problem, because A, they don't know exactly, they still don't know exactly where all this oil is coming from. They say that all the tanks are sealed, which is quite possible, but 300 ton, that's a shitload of fuel to go into the ocean, and that's a major problem. That when a thing like that happens, you first have to get people on that boat to really establish what's going on, what are the possibilities. I don't agree all that much, you know, about the slowness of reaction, because you do have to find out what the story is, and it's clear they still don't really know.
I think
there is a legal obligation through IMO for countries to have the response stuff all available.
And I think what I was picking up on was a comment that Mike Lee made, which is that Maritime New Zealand or Maritime Auckland has a lot of gear that's available and expertise that's available. There are also a lot of experts. It wasn't just random people on the beach in Tauranga, and those people were turned away when maybe they would have had something to say about the actual cleanup. Apparently New Zealand is a leading expert in some sort of wool absorbing thing that you just chuck and absorb
it
up.
That's right.
And instead they've put toxic dispersal stuff all over the oil to make it sink to the bottom. I mean, it's just these kind of strategy things that seem a bit
lame. But it's actually consistent of that system, isn't it? That monetary system whereby here we are, we're local experts, but we're allowed to do it overseas. The last thing you expect us to do is to do it at home and for our people. And the other observation I noticed too for the government was they made sure that they were getting embarrassed when local people wanted to start the cleanup earlier. And for me, I had no sympathies for the government. And did you notice the media spin that the government tried to put on? You know, what a waste of time, you've been really silly. Yet it's the locals that have to live with it. It's the locals that are going to be there every day looking at that mess for the next 30 years.
And how can taking oil away be possibly detrimental to the cleanup effort? I mean, even if it's not part of the organized response, you can't lock people out from trying to clean up their own back garden.
And it's quite interesting because it's about the New Zealand spirit as well, which is that we'll muck out and you make them feel useful by allowing them to muck out. And they're not stupid. That's the other thing. New Zealanders are incredibly resourceful, so they're not going to be going out there and wading through toxic material unless they are safe. Can I just ask you about media?
Isn't it ironic to people, you know, that we're going to clean all that oil and they're going to put it in landslides in Auckland?
Right, landfills in Auckland.
Yeah.
Oh, great. And so we can all enjoy it.
They can really enjoy it.
That's my question, you know. I mean, there's very little known of who are these companies who are dealing with this stuff. Mm. Is it Trans-Pacific?
That'd be great, wouldn't it?
It almost must be.
Yeah.
And where does it go? Indeed, in a landfill. What are you talking about?
Yep.
I thought this stuff was highly toxic and this and that. Is it going to leach in where?
Yeah.
And these are the things they come up with. These, they give very little information.
Yep.
You know, you got a stupid minister saying that this what they sprayed on the oil, which is stuff which is forbidden in Sweden, UK doesn't allow it on the coastline, and then you got a stupid minister saying, "Well, it's like shampoo or dishwashing liquid."
Yeah, we don't put that in the sea either.
I'm going to suggest, why don't you wash your hair with that stuff you spray on there?
We could bottle it, couldn't we?
He probably did, because a lot of his hair is gone, isn't it?
That's right.
Using someone else's toxic shampoo.
I suggest that we put all the oil into barrels and send it to Liberia.
That's right. They're probably already suffering, though. And can I just ask about the media response, Greg? Have you been following it in the papers? What's your feeling about how it's been covered?
Yeah, look, I've been following it the way everybody else has, reading the Herald, and I haven't watched much on TV, to be honest. I don't seem to be able to turn the TV on around news time with my lifestyle at the moment. But I, Yeah, look, I think the media's been distracted by the World Cup, and I think that the media didn't really do a great job, and I think that, it, you know, yesterday's Herald, for the first time, there was a really good spread on it, which was taking some responsibility back into the media for, at last, for not just following the government line on it, but actually doing some number crunching and actually doing some decent interviews and actually getting some attitude in there, which I think the New Zealand media's been missing for a long time. I think that it's just become... the media has become scared of its own power in some ways, and of course, as we know, the media is terribly constrained these days by the economic necessities of shareholders are taking the resources from our news services, and we. But I think at last there's a little bit of attitude. Well, yeah, community radio, exactly. There's a little bit of attitude coming back into the media coverage. I don't really blame the media for being obsessed with the World Cup, because if it wasn't obsessed with the World Cup, it really wouldn't be reflecting New Zealand at the moment, because New Zealand is obsessed with the World Cup. And to be honest, the ship finally got on the front page, didn't it? And not perfect, but we're almost there. Is my view.
So, Martini, are you following this quite closely? What do you think the solution, or you know, where is this going now? What do they need to do, or what? Any thoughts?
Well, I think we have to really look at the shipping industry as a whole, and we have to raise the bar of safety. There is a system in place at the moment. It's called the ISM, International Safety Management, where there is all sorts of rules and regulations and paperwork which you need to follow. Then there is an issue called port state control. Now, with where the government agent in this case Maritime New Zealand, they have the ability to inspect these vessels, and they have the ability to detain vessels, so they are kept in port till issues with the ship and the crew are solved. But it is not working. This ship, there were deficiencies with this ship.
We're just saying bye to Reverend Moore. Have a lovely
see you, mate.
Yeah, week, and we're going to come and see you in the containers in Aotearoa Square.
There were faults with this ship. They were discovered in China, and it is reported. But China just let the ship go. It didn't do anything.
Oh, there were problems with this particular ship.
Yeah. And then the
what
ship.
What kind of problems?
All sorts of problems, indeed. Charts, lifeboats, firefighting, emergency, the ability to keep your oil in the bilge just to below a certain level, and that's an interesting one. How come that ended all up in the bilge? But the Australians, they actually detained the vessel for one day in July. It came back in September. They followed it up. Some issues were resolved. In fact, most issues were resolved. Then the ship came to Bluff, and indeed, Maritime New Zealand came on board and inspected the vessel. But here you got a thing, you know. I don't think Maritime New Zealand, if they cannot detain the vessel after it just been in Australia, because basically, what if they would do something serious, they would say, well, the Australians didn't do a good job. And I don't think that's ever going to happen. The bottom line is that the safety bar has to be raised. It has to be raised. If you can't find the people to mend these vessels, then this vessel cannot sail. It's simple as that. And
I think it's an interesting reflection on globalization and corporatization generally, that the inspectors and the level of management of industry is really low. I mean, you can see that with food safety, that there are fewer meat inspectors in terms of the checking agricultural produce that comes into the country, in terms of what you're saying in terms of aviation safety. You know, if you reduce the bar enough, you get more and more accidents. And you can't expect this to be the only ship that's a bit, you know, rusted with poor crew and no charts. I mean, there must be hundreds of them. It just happens to be the one that's
in all honesty, there was nothing wrong with the ship. The ship is all right.
Right.
It's the people. It's the people who operate and maintain the vessel. That's where the problem is.
Right.
Ships itself, you know, I mean, it's quite incredible. to go on a reef at 17 knots, and for a ship, that's fast. I can tell you that.
Yeah.
You know, I mean,
put it in perspective. I think the Quick Cat does 23, doesn't it?
Exactly. Yeah. You know, and I'm kind of amazed that it wasn't really worse than it
right.
was. You
okay,
know.
Okay. So you reckon the ship wasn't as much of a rust bucket as everyone keeps going on about?
No. It isn't. There are things wrong, but the main problem with shipping is the people. That is, and the oversight. You know, you talk about inspectors. Well, that's a big problem with Pike River, isn't it? We didn't have the mining inspectors. How ridiculous is this? You have an incredible dangerous operation, and you know, if you dig holes in the ground and get stuff out, to me that's dangerous.
Yeah. And also shortcutting safety on that, and saying, well, they needed another thing for the gases to come out.
Exactly.
And they didn't put one in.
And that's government responsibility.
Mm.
But it, you know, this government, they want to leave everything to the business. The business will take care of it.
Mm.
Well, bollocks.
Mm.
The only thing business take care of is their own profits.
Mm.
And if they can cut corners, they will.
You've been listening to the Interviews from Island Life, our weekly look at Waiheke people, events and issues, every Saturday morning from 10 till 12, with interviews repeated on Wednesdays at 7 p.m. and Thursdays at 12:30 p.m. Island Life is brought to you by The Village Butchery, the place to go for great cuts of meat and friendly service. You'll find them at 102 Ocean View Road, Onirua.